little steps to take for getting and hopefully staying on the, at least on the platform of Nama Bas, the clearing platform. We talked about the central position of Pramada, the sense of inattentiveness, especially during japa. And the different kinds of inattentiveness. We talked about some steps we could take to overcome sleepiness, distraction, and lack of interest. Sleepiness by getting enough sleep. By not eating too much before you go to bed at night, not reading your email late at night, things that lead to a restless night. Attentiveness by the effort to simply bring the mind back to the holy name whenever it wanders. And finally, developing intensity by actually crying to Krishna for help. You can understand that if we are actually engaged in the process like this, the holy name will work. It becomes effective. It cleanses the heart. Lord Chaitanya says that it's chepo darpana marjanam, it cleanses the heart, but it really becomes activated when we become, at least on the clearing platform. Otherwise, as we learn from Prabhupada, it's a little inactive. So as soon as the chanter goes onto the clearing platform, the holy name becomes activated and starts to clean. And therefore, if we're working very hard to stay on this right platform, we see the dirty things go away and everything become auspicious. And when Prabhupada was discussing about hearing Bhagavatam with rapt attention, he says you have to hear with rapt attention, but to hear with rapt attention you have to be pure in mind. You can understand why that is, because lust, greed, anger, these are distractions and they captivate your mind and take it away. So the mind has to be clean. But you can't have a clean mind unless all the actions are clean or your actions are pure. And then Prabhupada said you cannot be pure in action unless you're pure in eating, sleeping, mating and defending. That he means even the most basic activities of life which we share with the beasts in the field have to be done in a pure way. Then it can happen. Then we also discuss the attitude of frankness or simplicity, sharalata, and the mood of humility, confession, and so on. For myself, I noticed that when I started to make a big endeavor to concentrate my mind and not be deflected from the holy name, that at a certain point I began to experience what I can only describe as mental discomfort or mental distress while chanting. And I noticed that not thinking of anything else, not being attracted to anything else, still because of that distress, my mind would tend to go away from the holy name and think of something else, and the distress would go away. And then I noticed this was happening, this mental discomfort or this distress, this kind of uneasiness. And it was causing me to think of something else. So I decided that the way to deal with this was to tolerate the distress or the uneasiness and keep on concentrating. Because the instruction are you should concentrate on the holy name. I could say, you know, chanting the holy name causes me disturbance, so I'm going to stop chanting. And I knew that was a trick of Maya. So I thought I'd just keep on chanting and see what happened. And then what happened is that mental distress came out more and more, and it revealed itself as grief. I went into a state of real sorrow, and what it was grief about was the fact that I had forgotten Krishna, that I had come to the material world, that Prabhupada had given me this Hare Krishna mantra, and I was taking so long to even begin to chant it, and so on. All these things I felt was feeling really bad about. And then I thought, you know, it's good to feel bad about these things. But it just came. You know, it wasn't like I had to talk myself into it. And then I thought, well, you know, this is my own experience, but you know, maybe our great acharyas don't go through this, but, you know, most of those people descended from the spiritual world. I'm definitely working my way up from the reptiles or something, so my experience may be a little different from theirs. So it was actually, it was very, very healing kind of pain, that grief. And it's also, I think, the pain of false ego beginning to shatter, to become destroyed. But I didn't expect anything like that from construct. It really took me quite by surprise. And so I think that each of us, we have our own mentalities and our own issues, whatever they may be. And I think we just have to trust to the holy name, follow the directions for chanting properly, and let it do its job. And if, you know, because at first I thought this mental discomfort, why is this doing this to me? And then I had to say, well, this is it just must be part of the process. Then I realized it was actually quite good. We should feel bad. And I think I talked about that yesterday. That's not low self-esteem. You know, you see on the pop psychology, you got to feel good about yourself. So we're telling people you should feel bad. But it's certainly different from despair. You could understand that actually such a thing that develops like grief can be really, in even higher stages of development, remain as a component of feelings of separation from Krishna. So it's not bad at all. It's good. And we can know that all emotions become part of spiritual ecstasy in the end. So anyway, don't be deterred. Just keep trust to the holy name, and he'll do the necessary job. Let's turn to a few other offenses and look at those for a few minutes. The one that seems to take us a lot of trouble, or give us a lot of trouble, is Satan Ninda or Sadhu Ninda, blaspheming devotees, or a Vaishnava. This also takes some understanding. There was a perception, I guess, when I joined the movement, that blasphemy of devotees only applied to those who were above you in seniority, or maybe to those who were equal to you, but certainly not to those who were below you. This is false. Vishwanath Chakravarti also points this out. It sometimes to have a managerial position in ISKCON was thought to be a license to blaspheme devotees. It's not at all. The question comes up, what is a devotee? Sadhu Ninda is the way this is usually described. What is a sadhu? And in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam, there's a famous verse which gives the 26 qualities of a devotee. Merciful, tolerant, equal to everyone, truthful, pure-hearted, compassionate. I think we've seen this list. So you say, well, those 26 qualities, anybody who has those qualities, that's a sadhu. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur analyzes this, and he says that the qualities are of two kinds. I don't know if this is in the is this on the list too? This not there. No, it's not from Bhagavatam. It's huh? Yeah, from Harinam Chintamani. Not on the handout. But this is from Harinam Chintamani. There was a limit to how far the people who were doing this course would pay for photocopying. So some things were Xerox, some things not. But he says that qualities are of two kinds. And the words he uses is swarup, meaning essential, and tatasta, meaning, well, he calls it marginal. Direct and indigenous, and other things that are ornamental and visible but not essential. So, of these, he says, of these 26 qualities, one quality, he just says, one is essential. Krishna says, Matsharanam. He has taken shelter of me. Matsharanam. Takes the Lord as his only shelter. So here's the way Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. If by some good fortune one associates with the Vaishnava, he may develop a taste for the holy name and takes complete shelter at Krishna's lotus feet. Thus he develops the Swarup Lakshana, the essential sign, the essential characteristic. And then through continued chanting, he will gradually develop all the other lakshanas, or symptoms. The other symptoms are tatasta, marginal. But nevertheless, they are essentially present in a Vaishnava. Essentially present means they'll come out. They may not be manifest, but they'll come out. So, he continues to say that the Swarup Lakshana will be there for everybody. The Tatastha Lakshana, the marginal symptoms, will vary according to Varna and Ashram. And he says, once one has this, huh? Pure in one's defending? Okay, we'll stop with that. We'll ask what is being pure in one's defending. Defending means either you exercise in defending only to defend Krishna and Krishna's devotees. For your own defense, you rely upon Krishna. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada has told us this, that a devotee himself doesn't do anything. He says he's not so eager to defend himself, depends upon Krishna. But if he sees another devotee as being harmed, he'll rush to his defense. Or we defend the Sankirtan movement, we defend Krishna's honor. These are pure in defending. It's defending when there's no false ego. It's defending when Prabhupada talks about using anger in Krishna's service. Speaking of Hanuman, serving, and even Arjuna, it's not possible to fight in a battle without becoming angry. But it was Krishna's battle, and so it was pure. Okay? Yes.
Should we
Yeah, sure. You take ordinary precautions. Yeah, you can walk. Don't make Krishna do your work for you either. So the ordinary sensible things to do, one should do. Should you drive your car down the road with your eyes closed because Krishna will guide you? No. Don't make him do work for you. Yeah. Anyway, so to go back to this, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, once he has this symptom, surrender to Krishna, gradually but unfailingly the marginal symptoms appear in the devotee's character. Even if the marginal symptoms haven't reached full maturity in a surrendered devotee, and instead some serious discrepancies are visible in his character, he is still to be respected as a sadhu or saintly soul. This is the verdict of the scriptures as expressed in Lord Krishna's own words in the Bhagavad Gita. He's the sadhu eva samantavya. If he's rightly situated in his determination, then sadhu eva. And it must be given full respects. So this is one thing that should be seen. But if we are actually interested in making advancement in Krishna consciousness, it will be our business to prefer. We'll become so strong in avoiding blasting devotees. You'll always give somebody the benefit of the doubt. It can't be. Our attitude won't be, well, let's see, is this person a sadhu or not? I don't think so. You know, then it's okay. Most devotee wants to avoid offending. Well, he just might be. He just might be a sadhu. After all, has done a lot of service to Krishna. I better be careful and give him the benefit of the doubt. This would be the attitude of somebody who, just for his own spiritual life, didn't want to commit this offense. So we shouldn't be looking for, is it okay? We should be looking to avoid it. Avoid it whenever possible. Another, we should always be the well-wisher of a devotee. That should always be our attitude. Whoever, whatever he is, actually we should be everybody's well-wisher, but especially of devotees, we should always be wishing them well. If we think somebody needs to be punished, we want them to be punished by developing more Krishna conscious. It's because of this intense well-wishing that we see that even when somebody like Narada Muni curses somebody, they benefit from it. Because even in their curses, the benediction comes through. Because they just wish everybody well. May you become a devotee of Krishna. That benediction is always there. Even somebody who's an offender, they wish them well. So look at somebody. They may be new devotees. They may be doing so many things wrong. But especially if you see that they are trying, then we should judge somebody not for what they are, but for what they are trying to become. You could see this person has this idea. You could see this person is trying. Give it to them. In just a short time, this will be a great devotee. This is what's trying to come out of this person. Yeah, there's a few little garbage hanging on the outside. That'll soon be gone. I don't take that seriously. So always judge people by what they're trying to become. That's some advice. I mentioned that one reason we have it's easy to chant Nama Bas in the beginning is because we're under illusion. We think all the devotees are great souls, and it's not exactly that we're wrong. If you take Even somebody who likes Krishna consciousness, if you compare them with the rest of the world, they're great souls. And when Prabhupada met the parents of devotees, he would say, especially like if the devotee was a son, he would say to the mother, you must be a great soul to have a son like this, because, and then he would point out that it says in the Vedas that a son inherits the qualities of the mother and the daughter inherits the qualities of the father. So if it was a son, he would say to the mother, you must be a great soul because your son is a devotee. Or if it was a daughter, say to the father, the same thing. Your daughter's a devotee, you must be a great soul. And this is not flattery. So this is called being generous in your judgments. From my childhood, the Christians that I was, community I was part of, they used to call it being charitable, kind of old-fashioned use of English. You know, it's in the Bible, faith, hope, and charity. Charity means that kind of love that wishes everybody well. It's old English now. It doesn't just mean giving money, but it means being magnanimous in your feelings toward everybody. So it's being charitable toward people. So when in the beginning everybody looked like a great devotee, actually you weren't wrong. But when you get to know them, you see there are other things that are there, that are not characteristic of great devotees, yet they're there. And because we have a false ego also, then these bad qualities, they strike sparks like rocks against each other, and things happen. So it's not, if in the beginning you were just naive or foolish, then you know what everybody's like, devotees are like. But you know, we have to go to another stage of, we can call it wise foolishness. Like the simplicity, the childlike simplicity of a great soul. But it doesn't mean they can't tell right from wrong or good from bad or judge people for what they are. They know great souls. But still, there's a kind of childlike simplicity in them. And part of that wisdom comes from just being very, very compassionate and very magnanimous and seeing everybody for what they're trying to become and wishing them well. So if we develop these good qualities in ourselves, everybody else will look better. And the difficulty, why Vaishnava Aparad becomes a real difficulty, is because a lot of times we are fault-finding. We don't just see faults, we are actually actively searching them out and wanting to find them. And this is because, this happens because we are being dishonest with ourselves. Because what we're really worried about are our own faults. We know intuitively anyway that we are full of faults and we find short of the mark. Yet I cannot, in a way, I'm condemning myself. I'm condemning myself, thinking I'm no good, I'm not a devotee, I'm so horrible. And I imagine this judgment being passed upon me by God or by my spiritual master. If he only knew me like I really am, he would never see my face. I think like this. And I can't stand it. And I lose self-respect in my own eyes. And so what I do is, since I want to feel better about myself, I try to do so by finding fault with everyone else. And so we see a person who's become a fault finder, really they're really worried about themselves. But they're not open and honest about it. They can't admit it. And so they point their finger at everyone else. So there's a saying, I think Prabhupada said this, that when you point your finger at somebody else, there's three fingers pointing back at you. So it's very typical in a temple. You get one particular, many times have happened, there's one particular man who will be very much disturbed by sexual desire. And he comes to me and he tells me, I saw this brahmachari looking at this woman. I saw that. Everybody, and then sort of he has a picture of the world. Everybody's obsessed with lust. But he's talking about himself. And he's really worried about himself, but he can't admit it openly. Because he's afraid. If he does, he'll be rejected. And that's why if you have to counsel people, they have to know that they're not going to be rejected, because then they can come to terms. So if this dishonesty there, this lack of simplicity, then one becomes a fault finder. And fault finding is the characteristic defect that you find almost in any high demand religious community. If you ever spend time with monks or nuns, people that have a high demand, high intensity, high discipline, tightly associated with each other, this fault finding, they always call it backbiting, talking about people behind their backs, is like a sort of generic difficulty. And that's just because of the high standards. And we're concerned about our own failure to live up to them. We don't face that failure honestly and openly, and we compensate for it by finding the faults of other people. So that's how that develops, because of this lack of honesty. And one cannot have a spirit of generosity with people if this has become our difficulty. So if I start to look around and everybody looks like they have a certain fault, that's what I notice in people all the time, is the same fault. Somebody's always hungry, they're always eating too much. That's probably my problem. And I've projected it onto other people. Other people may really have those faults. Not to say that my perceptions are fictitious, but that's the only thing I may notice about them. We'll come back and talk about this. You want to save it for the end? Just write it down. No, I think let's wait till the end of the class. And now let's talk about this fault finding. I'll do that. If we talk about this one right now, then we can go on. I want to discuss another offense before class is over. You have something to say about this southern India?
Is that how much does somebody instructs you because
you
How is it?
You must find fault sometimes. You know, Prabhupada had an attitude about this. He apologized to us for, he said, it's not my business to point out the defects of Vaishnavas. He said, I do not wish to point out the defects of Vaishnavas. However, I am your spiritual master. It is my duty. So if we have to do it, it should be in that mood. And not that we're eager to find it. We're not delighted when we see a fault in somebody. We see somebody have a fault and our heart leaps with joy. We know there's something really wrong with them. That we're really in this mentality. So sometimes it's necessary as a matter of duty. But this is one characteristic of fanaticism. That what you call fanatic, people become so angry at other people. You go out on Sankirtan, you're a new devotee, everybody's out there having sense gratification. You blast everybody all the time for having sense gratification because secretly you'd like to be doing it yourself. So we should, ultimately we should have no secrets. There aren't any anyway, but we manage to keep them from ourselves sometimes. Yes, you have something to say about that? There are different ways that you should, if it's necessary, because you have to know people's strengths and weaknesses. For example, if you're a devotee on the Majjhima platform, mid-level devotee in advancement, you're supposed to discriminate. There's certain devotees you associate with. There's certain people take instruction from. There's certain people who are your equals. There's certain people you give instruction to. And there's certain people you avoid. You're supposed to avoid the demons, actually. But sometimes there's devotees that you think, I'd better not hang, be in their association. Because every time I get in that association, I find myself doing something that I know isn't right. Gossiping or whatever it may be. So you have to discriminate. Just to discriminate itself is not fault-finding or blasphemy. And if it's necessary to point out some defect, either to one person or another person, the etiquette is that if you have to say something about somebody that's negative, you should first by praising that person's good qualities. And then you can mention the bad qualities. Also, there's things we learn. You don't say, you're like this. You just talk about my perception. You don't repeat what you've heard from other people. You say your own perception is like this, with the possibility that it may be a misperception. This is something you should understand. People will not listen to you. If you have some what we call constructive criticism, right? People will not listen to it unless they know you wish them well. If they know you wish them well, even if what you have to say is painful, they're much more likely to listen to it. In the early 70s, in America, where the anti-cult movement started attacking us, I'm the kind of person that... these people were just horrible, and their idea was that we should stop to exist. That Krishna consciousness was a dangerous, destructive cult. They said really a lot of stupid things, how that a vegetarian diet was protein deprivation, and there was sleep deprivation. I mean, so many things. But I read their literature, and I even sat down and read, their best book by an academic at that time. This book by a Yale psychiatrist about thought reform in China. And I saw things in the Hare Krishna movement that they were saying that was true. I didn't see it everywhere. It wasn't like essential what Krishna consciousness was about. But I saw the misuse of power. I saw leaders that had unhealthy relationships with those who followed them. I saw all these things going around. And these people actually had something valuable to say to us. We couldn't listen. Even I couldn't take them seriously. First of all, I couldn't even say in the company of devotees, what they say about this is true. If I said that to any devotee, they would have said, you're a demon. I couldn't say it to devotees. I couldn't really do anything except try to blow them out of the water, because their solution to our having problems was to say we shouldn't exist, not to say you would be helped if you would do this and this. That's not what they said. So if they had been our well-wishers, we might have profited from some of their criticisms. But they weren't. So you can judge from this on an individual level also. By the way, I have since met with these very same people. For the last several years, I'm a member of the American Family Foundation, which is the premier anti-cult organization in America. They no longer think we're a destructive cult. They think we may have used to have been, at least in some parts, but are not anymore. Because one thing is, they see we are able to criticize ourselves, so they think that shows that there's some normal, healthiness about us. But when I sat down with these people, I told them what I told you. I said, you said many things that were true, but because you didn't wish us well, none of us could hear it. And they had to admit that they were wrong in doing like that. So let's go on. Let's discuss another very interesting offense. The last one, or the second to last, depending on the tenth offense, which is not to have complete faith in the chanting of the holy names or to maintain material desires, even after understanding so many instructions in the matter. These two ways of putting it are synonymous. There's a famous definition of faith in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I think it may be in this thing. Is it in there? Lord Chaitanya defines what faith is. The meaning of Shraddha. And he says, if I can paraphrase it, it's the very strong conviction that if I attain Krishna consciousness, automatically all other things will be accomplished. That's the definition of faith. And Prabhupada associates faith with it as an act of buddhi, of intelligence. Intelligence is the instrument by which we place faith. And of course, to be successful in Krishna consciousness, we have to have one-pointed intelligence, vyavasa atmika buddhi. And this will only happen if we have this confidence that if I put my main energy, all my energy into Krishna consciousness, it is not that in some other area I'm going to be lacking. So if I'm maintaining a material desire, that means my faith is weak. Notice very carefully that the offense is not having a material desire. The offense is maintaining a material desire. It's to be expected material desires will be there. But I'm maintaining that material desire when I am not asking Krishna for its removal. For example, there's a famous statement by St. Augustine in his Confessions. He wrote that, he said, when I was very young and foolish, I used to pray, Lord, give me continence, that is to say, continence, that means celibacy. Lord, give me celibacy, but not just yet. That's maintaining a material desire. Krishna, please destroy all my material desires, but in 10 years. This one I want to satisfy first. That's the offense. So we have to go through when we see the material desires, and because actually as we become clearer, our material desires will also become clearer to us. We'll see them. And we should target every one of them for destruction. just like the forester goes to the forest with a spray can, and the trees that are going to be cut down, they have this X on them, and then the guys come with a chainsaw and cut them down. So every material desire, we have to put this X on them. That's what it means. Just a minute. Now, one reason, because we even get attached, we're attached to the idea of gratifying these senses in a certain way, and we really want to experience it, then I'll give it up, or something like that. Or I'm trying to figure out some way I can satisfy this desire and still be Krishna conscious. Because it's a lack of faith, because I think if I attain Krishna consciousness, if I don't have this desire satisfied, then I'll still be unhappy. This is a mistake. Krishna consciousness will satisfy you in every department. If you think that this desire will satisfy you, fulfilling this desire will satisfy you, understand that you're an illusion. It will not. It will make you suffer. Suffering is the nature of desires, material desires. Krishna will satisfy your desires. We should have this faith. All my desires will be satisfied by Krishna better than ever I could do myself. But actually, he'll reveal our desires for what they are. As we become pure, also our pure desires become revealed. The garbage comes off, and we discover what we really love, what we really want, what we really long for. It's all Krishna. So they become purified. That means our desires will be revealed for what they actually are, and then Krishna will satisfy them. We need to have that confidence. So faith, Prabhupada said, is created by association with devotees. And presumably it helps to be devotees who have more faith than we do. We should seek out such devotees. There's another doubt when we see how big and powerful our material desires are. We doubt that they can be removed. It's too much, it's too heavy. I've tried a few times, it doesn't go away. It's like a weed, but you want to dig a weed up and you pull and it won't come up and you start digging up the root and the root goes down and down and down and down. What to do? But this doubt is also should not be allowed, because we should understand how material desires become removed. They are removed by Krishna, not by us. And specifically, material desires are removed by Krishna in the form of Nrisingadeva. In the fifth canto, 18th chapter, there's a prayer. It's verse 18, 8 and 9 rather. There's a prayer that Prahlad Maharaj give with the residents of Harivarsha to Nrisingadeva. And he's calling upon Nrisingadeva to enter into his heart and destroy his material desires. You know this prayer? It's really nice. Om Namo Bhagavate Narasimhaya. And then he prays, then he says, Namastejas, Tejas. So he's emphasizing, he's powerful. Tejas. He has the power of all power. Avir, Avir, Bhava. Notice the repetition. Just some of these typical things. The repetition means intensity. Prabhupada says this somewhere. Repetition indicates intensity. So he says, Avir, Avir, Bhava. Be manifest, be manifest. How? Vraja Nakra, Vraja Damstra. With your nails and your fangs, like bolts of lightning. Vraja means either lightning bolts or diamonds, but anyway, hard. And then there's the request, Karma Shayan Randaya Randaya. Again, the repetition is there. Destroy, destroy, karmashayan, my desires to enjoy in this material world. The longing for fruitive activities, which another verse in the Bhagavatam describes as the knot in the heart. Kridaya granti karmashayan. Tamo grasa grasa. Dispel, dispel darkness, illusion. So in other words, the modes of passion and the modes of ignorance. Om swaha abhayam abhayam atmani puhishtam om sham. Appear in my heart, atmani, and this way give me abhayam, fearlessness in this world. So this is the prayer. And then the next one, again, Prahlad Maharaj prays for world peace. It's also very nice. May all envious persons be satisfied. May everyone have auspicious good wishes toward each other, all living beings, and so on. So in commenting on these two verses, this is where Prabhupada remarks that Hiranyakashipu was the emblem of material desires, with the Hiranya for wealth and Kashipu for sex indulgence and sensual pleasures. He's the emblem of material desires. So all the desires in our heart, they're like a Hiranyakashipu in the heart. So he says, therefore the devotee should pray for Lord Nrisingadev. He said we should pray always to Lord Nrisingadev to appear in our hearts and destroy our Hiranyakashipu-like material desires. He says we should pray by saying, so we've been doing it. We may not have noticed that when we say Bahir Nrisinga Riddayet, Nrisinga is in my heart, this is actually a request for him to appear in our hearts and destroy our Hiranyakashipu like material desires. Maybe we thought all the demons were out there, but it turns out they're inside. We have met the enemy and he is us. Not us, but our minds. So, therefore, if we consider that our material desires are very strong and powerful and ferocious, and against them we are very weak, we should understand that it's not us who has to destroy them. It's that we have to ask Nrisingadev to appear in our hearts and do the job. Can anyone stand against Nrisingadev? No. When Hiranyakashipu had the whole universe terrorized. Prabhupada referred to Stalin and Hitler as the tiny Hiranyakashipus of today. He was big time. Bad guy. And he was destroyed. Like a cat destroys a mouse. So it can be done. Why doesn't it happen? Well, maybe I'm not asking him. Maybe I am saying, please destroy my material desires, but not just yet. Please destroy my material desires, except for this one. If he's going to come, we have to pray with some intensity. Please do it. But the idea that it can't be done, that's not allowed. We should be clear like that. Huh? Okay, maybe we'll stop now and have some discussion. And there's tomorrow we'll wind it up. A few more considerations. That's all the particular offenses I want to discuss. I think in particular. Other offenses you'd like to bring up, we can turn to those or whatever else you want to discuss. Yeah.
Well, you're talking about having a very not being foolish, being able to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not mechanical. It will happen if, first of all, you have that mood, that attitude, that I should try to see people's good side. That if we become correctly situated in the clearing platform, we'll find a way to do it. It looks almost like we have to do contradictory things at the same time. How do I be somebody's well-wisher, see their good side, not find their faults, but still be clear in my judgments? Be clear in my judgments without being judgmental. How do I do that? Well, it can be done. There are people like that. But and if we have the right attitude, and we become ourselves progressive in our Krishna consciousness, we default finding tendency, as Prabhupada said, we should direct toward ourselves. In a mood that I've already described, if we become humble, then we'll see how to do this. Yeah.
I have had experience that, you know, involved in the service, and it should satisfy myself, not so bothered by
this. Yeah, right. If you're happy in making advancement in Krishna consciousness, everyone looks better. If you're blocked in your Krishna consciousness, if you're baffled in your spiritual life, you'll be looking for faults. You'll be disappointed in your biggest hope. That happens to us. But when we become devotees, certain high standards, we're very good at that in ISKCON. We're very good in inculcating in people, by cementing in people's hearts, this ideal, the pure devotee, and this goal, going back home, back to Godhead. What happens to us is the spiritual master becomes for us, sits in the heart, our own hearts. We internalize. He becomes, the spiritual master becomes our conscience. I think of myself as being judged by the spiritual master. And we are very, very good, and our move very effective at instilling this in people. So that there was one big devotee who left our movement and was in quite a state of distress. Basically because he was not following the orders of Prabhupada and his conscience was bothering him. He was taken to a prominent New Age therapist for treatment. This New Age therapist, after talking to the guy, realized this guy was judging himself all the time by Prabhupada's standards. So he gave him certain exercises to make him feel better. Those exercises involved blaspheming Prabhupada, tearing up his picture, and so on, to drive out this inner Prabhupada, which was passing such a devastating judgment on this person. That's what he did. So we have this ideal in our hearts. It's there. It doesn't go away. We know what we should be doing with our lives. So if we're falling short, it's very, very hard to deal with this. If we become baffled, not that we're falling short, falling short's one thing. I can always acknowledge that I'm not perfect, but if I'm making advancement, then I actually can be hopeful and joyful in my basic attitude. Even though I see my so many faults, my basic attitude is one of happiness. But if I'm not making any advancement, if I'm not going anywhere, then I can enter into an unconscious state of despair, depression, anger, and then I direct the anger at somebody else. Whose fault is it that I'm not Krishna conscious? I become angry at other devotees, at ISKCON, the gurus, the God. And I don't take any responsibility myself. This is what happens.
Supposing they're trying to make advancement and become good devotees, they're saying how one should give someone the benefit of the doubt and see what they're trying to be. Supposing they feel that our seniors or authorities are being judgmental and they're how do we deal with that?
Well, we have to, if somebody's passing judgment on us, we also have to try to become generous. Something I was going to discuss tomorrow. We have in Chaitanya Charitamrita a story about fault finding and passing judgment. Yeah, the story of Ramachandra Puri. Very, very revealing. The psychological dynamics of this. But he was a fault finder. And when he found fault with Lord Chaitanya, Lord Chaitanya's response was, actually he's right, sannyasi shouldn't eat so much. And that's how he dealt with him, because he was his superior. So if this happens to us, if it's all possible, I know sometimes you become agitated, you got to go home, you got to cool down. Never write an email letter, and send it, send button. You know, has caused more damage. After that's the forward button. That spreads the stuff around the world. You know, if you have to write something, you know, don't mail it until you've read it again 24 hours later. I have a policy, actually, that I try to follow. I don't know how successful I am. But in any case, if I'm angry at somebody, whoever it may be, even somebody who's a disciple of mine, I try, if at all possible, to wait until I'm not angry before I talk to them. You know, I just let the anger go away, and then I talk to them. I just found that's, even if what I have to say is right, if you're angry, it comes out too harsh, looks like something else. And when your superiors are on your case, the really cool thing to do, the Prabhupada said we should have a cool head, right? The really cool thing to do is just to say, well, what can I use to help me? Yes, he's being judgmental and so on. That's not my problem. If it's a problem, it's his problem, and I'm not in a position to deal with his problems. But if there's truth to what he has to say, then I should accept it. Could somebody turn that fan off? I'm having trouble hearing. Yeah, go ahead.
When I'm in a situation where someone instructs me, I may feel it's not appropriate. Generally, I think about it afterwards and see that, well, maybe it was not correct this time, but it's many other times when I do that though, and I'm not seeing.
Yeah, that's true. That instruction is also there someplace. That even if I'm accused of something I'm innocent of, I've done so many things I've gotten away with. This must be the punishment for that. That's a fact. Anything else? Over here?
What are the different steps might go to that? Some are horrible, like
And some are what?
Horrible. Some like maybe I want to enjoy Mahaprasad, like
this. Yeah.
So should I pray to remove all this or should I deal with them?
Well, I guess you can deal with the ones that are the most disturbing to your advancement in Krishna consciousness in that order. Others will become... there's two kinds of material desires. Pious and impious. Ultimately, we have to become free from all of them. I mean, when Lord Chaitanya prays Nadanam, Najanam, and then Sundari Kavitam. Kavitam is pure. I mean, it's pious. It's not attached to piety. So sometimes we can become attached to not only... Well, let's put it this way. We have to become free not only from our sinful reactions, but the reactions to our piety also. We want to go back home, back to Godhead. The desire to enjoy Mahaprasad. The Prabhupada, that's understandable. But ultimately, of course, on the highest level, our ability—it's like anything else. Honoring prasad can be done in many levels, just like chanting the holy name can be done in many levels. So also can honoring prasad. And when Raghunath Das Goswami was taking the remnants of Jagannath that had gone spoiled, so they were put in the field, and then the animals had eaten, and what the animals wouldn't even eat, he would take that, wash it off, and honor it. And when Lord Chaitanya heard about this, he came to him and said, "You're having a feast, and you're not inviting me." Believe me, it was a feast. It was a feast. It was a real feast. One morsel of that prasad as prepared by Raghunath Das Goswami. That was a feast. So there's a level of appreciation. When I was a new devotee, just moved into the temple, one of the worst things that we had to do on Monday was eat what we called merge. Because the doctrine was prasadam is always pure, it cannot be contaminated and therefore should not be thrown away. So the Sunday feast guests would leave stuff on their plates. And it would be collected and put into a big tray. And Monday morning, they would bring this tray out. And before you could eat anything else, that had to go. And they would not throw that away. This could go on for several days. They would not throw that away unless it was really gone rancid. I'd taste something and say, "This is spoiled." And the guy said, "No, it just has a little buzz on it." It was like this, you know. And one day, one morning, I had my merch. And I was honoring it. And then I tasted something, I felt something very weird in my mouth. And I spit it out, and it was a wad of bubble gum. And I ran to the sink room and started retching. You know, I was just so sick to my stomach, and I said, "That's it. It may be pure, but this bubble gum is not." And I just refused to do it anymore. I mean, you should see the people that came to the Sunday feast. Just the thought of that bubble gum was so... But then shortly afterwards, a letter came from Prabhupada. Somebody finally complained to Prabhupada about this. And Prabhupada said, "No, it is not required." He said, "It's true that prasadam does not become contaminated, but it depends upon your faith." I said, "My faith isn't there." Not Raghunath Das Goswami. It was so weird, you know. The other thing was in those days that Sodom had to be respected. So if somebody would spill something on the floor, like a cup of juice, I mean, your first time you go to the temple, it's a Sunday feast, and you see some guy down on the floor, a brahmachari going... You wonder, who are these people? But that was a very common activity. We had one devotee named Kapinder who was especially a floor sucker. Some capacity. I'm still here. Anything else? You want to say something?
You were saying about this Lord Nisinga Thakur.
Yeah.
Closing the heart and...
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. The
mm-hmm.
I heard that your Sattva Bhaktan of the Torah is described as a different Krishna Leela in Vrindavan. By hearing different pastimes of Krishna, that has to remove different...
Anarthas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that connection, it's also said that the ones with Krishna kills, Krishna correspond to the attachments that Krishna removes.
Yeah.
The ones that Balaram kills, right, correspond to...
Ones that you have to...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's correct. Huh? Yeah. I think you'll find everything we say here covers that. There's how much we do, and then there's what Krishna does.
Can you give examples?
I am sorry, I don't remember that. What's the name? What book is that? That's described. Huh? Yeah, Shikshamrita. I've been waiting for a really good translation to really get into that book. So I noticed that, and sort of for future notice. But I remember looking at it and decided that, in one sense. When I saw what they were, it didn't really add any essentially new information. But I can't remember exactly which ones were what each of these demons meant. Do you know?
No,
I don't remember. If anybody does, we can talk about it.
So, I read something about an interesting point, you know, that Krishna and Kamsa represent the false ego. And the six sons of the Bhakti represent the six enemies.
Yeah, that's right. That's in the Bhagavatam. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so interesting that Kamsa is killing. The false ego is killing the six enemies. So our false ego,
it doesn't work exactly that way. It doesn't work. But those things have to be destroyed in order for Krishna to appear.
Yes.
Those six enemies have to be destroyed. And it's not actually Kamsa that purified Devaki, but it was the fear. The fear of Kamsa representing false ego that destroyed these. We should be afraid, Prabhupada said, of these things. We should be afraid of material existence. We should be afraid of becoming entangled. And that fear is purifying. As I recall, that's what Prabhupada says in commenting on this, on the meaning of that. Yeah.
Can you explain briefly what it might mean that the one that Krishna removes and the one that we have to work on ourselves?
No, the ones Balaram removes.
Yeah. Can you just explain the difference?
No, I can't. I really haven't studied that much, that particular thing that much, and. It's just what as far as I know, the Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. Yes? Yeah? What did he say? Oh, yeah, there is. He did give a question. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Yeah, I asked that same question. He said that Balaram represents Guru, Adi Guru.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So there's Balaram's mercy after all. To me, this process is something like When you sit yourself correctly, according to the instructions of the spiritual master, you place yourself in the internal potency, and then it's the internal potency that's really doing everything. It's like a woman who's laboring to give birth. We say it's labor, but really, you know, she's in the grip of material nature. I think it's something a man can't really experience to the extent that a woman, there's a baby, and the baby's going to come out. That's going to happen. And the labor that a woman has to do is basically cooperate with the process. But it's a force bigger than you are. That force bigger than you are is not the external potency, it's the internal potency. I mean, that's my own example, but... that's how Krishna consciousness comes about. Anyway, thank you for that. Yeah?
So, you said maybe we should just put our own faults and
just tell
everybody else's story. Mm-hmm. But still, he's going to have some responsibility in different areas.
That's true. You know, it hasn't. That's why I'm trying to talk about these things.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, this doesn't absolve people who have responsibilities of executing them. But I have to take responsibility for my own spiritual life too, and what I can do. That's what we're talking about. And if you want to change the whole culture of ISKCON, we have to start with ourselves. It's a big mistake to try to purify other people as a substitute for purifying yourself. First, let's work on ourselves. Then, when we try to help other people, we'll be effective. Oh, I agree fully. But somehow or other, if we know what we're doing, whatever the faults of ISKCON are, we can still make spiritual advancement. I think so. I thought maybe I had it relatively easy because then I've heard people come and describe, you know, some devastating experiences they have, and somehow or other I was never subjected to such things. But then I've talked to other people who've had equally or even more devastating experiences who managed to turn it around and kind of use the energy of the negative for a positive result. No, it is possible. We don't. I mean, it's really not our business to make it hard for people. Unfortunately, we do that sometimes. But if we're properly situated in our sadhana, according to this understanding, we will also be able to be a shelter for other people and to be able to give others good advice and direction. Yes? Yeah. Not eating pizza at 9 o'clock at night. Not eating pizza at 9 o'clock at night. Take a cold shower in the morning. These are all helpful hints, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned, if I believe, that when he involved the demon, when Krishna kills a demon, Krishna comes into our heart and removes the kristic anartha, like retention, there's so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
But when Balaram kills a demon, he gave us the tool by which we have to make the effort to kill the demon.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, sure.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
You experience in Philadelphia, you say about this reform with a group of devotees.
Yeah.
And what experience do you have from this?
Well, we got started, and then there was somebody there who understood that revealing your mind in confidence was writing long things, finding everybody else's fault. And, okay, I'm going to reveal my mind to you. This is what's wrong with you, this is what's wrong with you, this is what's wrong with you, this is wrong with you. And that all added up to your faults always added up to you were envious of him. And then you would say, well, you know, if since you're telling me your perceptions about me, let me tell you my perceptions about you. And the guy would get really offended and say, see, that's proof that you're envious of me. And so there's a limit to how far we could go with the people available, I think. But still working on it.
By looking into astrology, just a little bit, I found out that some people have particular conjunctions that are very favorable to their controlling their mind very nicely, and others are very weak in that area.
Sure.
So then you were mentioning about machinery.
Yeah.
So for someone who has a very weak mind and who cannot concentrate and you know, has no determination, can you just pray to your machine?
Yeah, pray to all kinds of forms of Krishna. I don't know which one is the most appropriate for that. Astrology shows you your past good or bad deeds. So it's helpful to have had a pious past. That we know from Bhagavad Gita. If you don't have a pious past, it can be remedied. As Prabhupada said, I am your pious past. I created for you. Prahlad Maharaj, we have to end with this. Prahlad Maharaj is described in the seventh canto with the words Krishna Raha, that he has Krishna in his chart as a strong planetary influence. So the astrologer may not be able to see this, but if you have Krishna Raha, that makes Krishna work on your chart so that everything works ultimately in an auspicious way. So you should understand that even if it's the astrologer says you have this problem, well, it's not that it can't be overcome. Our business is to get the mercy of Krishna and Krishna Graha. Okay? So we'll finish up tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada.